and then back at me. "Where's Daddy?" he said. I squeezed my son's hot, sweaty hand and listened to the coughs and sniffles echoing round the church. I wondered how I could possibly explain my husband's death to his son. It was depression that killed Andrew, of course. Depression and guilt. But my son didn't believe in death, let alone in the capacity of mere emotions to cause it. Mr. Freeze's ice rays, perhaps. The puffin's lethal wingspan at a stretch. But an ordinary phone call from a skinny African girl? It was impossible to explain. I realized I would have to tell my son the whole story someday. I wondered where I would begin. It was 2 years before, in the summer of 2005, that Andrew had begun his long, slow slide into the depression that finally claimed him. It started on the day we first met Little B, on a lonely beach in Nigeria. The only souvenir I have of that first meeting is an absence where the middle finger of my left hand used to be. The amputation is quite clean. In place of my finger is a stump, a phantom digit that used to be responsible for the E, D, and C keys on my laptop. I can't rely on E, D, and C anymore. They go missing when I need them most. Pleased becomes please. Ecstasies becomes stasis. I miss my finger most on deadline days, when the copy checkers have all gone home and I'm typing up the last-minute additions to my magazine. We published an editorial once, where I said I was wary of sensitive men. I meant to say weary, of course, and after 100 outraged letters from the earnest boyfriends who'd happened to glance at my piece on their partner's coffee table, presumably in between giving a back rub and washing the dishes, I began to realize just how weary I was. It was a typographical accident, I told them. I didn't add it was the kind of typographical accident that is caused by a steel machete on a Nigerian beach. I mean, what does one call the type of meeting where one gains an African girl and loses E, D, and C? I do not think you have a word for it in your language. That's what Little B would say. I sat in my pew, massaged the stump of my finger, and found myself acknowledging for the first time that my husband had been doomed since the day we met Little B. The intervening 2 years had brought a series of worsening premonitions, culminating in the horrible morning 10 days earlier, when I had woken up to the sound of the telephone ringing. My whole body had crawled with dread. It had been an ordinary weekday morning. The June issue of my magazine was almost ready to go to the printers, and Andrew's column for the Times was due in too. Just a normal morning, but the soft hairs on the backs of my arms were up. I have never been one of those unhappy women who insist that disaster strikes from a clear blue sky. For me there were countless foretellings, innumerable small breaks with normalcy. Andrew's chin unshaved, a second bottle uncorked on a weekday night, the use of the passive voice on deadline Friday. Certain attitudes which have been adopted by this society have left this commentator a little lost. That was the very last sentence my husband wrote. In his Times column, he was always so precise with the written word. From a layperson, lost would be a synonym for bewildered. From my husband, it was a measured goodbye. It was cold in the church. I listened to the vicar saying, "Where, O death, is thy sting?" I stared at the lilies and smelled the sweet accusation of them. God, how I wish I had paid more attention to Andrew. How to explain to my son that the warning signs were so slight? That disaster, when it is quite sure of its own strength, will announce itself by hardly moving its lips. They say that in the hour before an earthquake, the clouds hang leaden in the sky. The wind slows to a hot breath, and the birds fall quiet in the trees of the town square. Yes, but these are the same portents that precede lunchtime, frankly. If we overreacted every time the wind eased up, we would forever be laying down under the dining room table, when we really should be laying the plates on top of it. Would my son accept that this is how it was with his father? The hairs on my arms went up, Batman, but I had a household to run. I never understood that he was actually going to do it. All I would honestly be able to say is that I woke up with the phone ringing and my body predicting some event that had yet to happen, although I never imagined it would be so serious. Charlie had still been asleep. Andrew picked up the phone in his study quickly before the noise of the ringing could wake our son. Andrew's voice became agitated. I heard it quite clearly from the bedroom.
"Just leave me alone," he said. "All that stuff happened a long time ago, and it wasn't my fault."
The trouble was, my husband didn't really believe that. I found him in tears. I asked him who it had been on the phone, but he wouldn't say. And then, since we were both awake and Charlie was still asleep, we made love. I used to do that with Andrew sometimes. More for him than for me, really. By that stage of our marriage, it had become a maintenance thing, like bleeding the air out of the radiators, just another part of running a household. I didn't know, in fact I still don't know, what awful consequences are supposed to ensue if one fails to bleed the radiators. It is not something a cautious woman would ever allow herself to discover. We didn't speak a word. I took Andrew into the bedroom, and we lay on the bed beneath the tall Georgian windows with the yellow silk blinds. The blinds were embroidered with pale foliage. Silk birds hid there in a kind of silent apprehension. It was a bright May morning in Kingston-upon-Thames, but the sunlight through the blinds was a dark and florid saffron. It was feverish, almost malarial. The bedroom walls were yellow and ochre. Across the creaking landing, Andrew's study was white, the colour, I suppose, of blank pages. That's where I retrieved him, after the awful phone call. I read a few words of his column over his shoulder. He'd been awake all night, writing an opinion piece about the Middle East, which was a region he had never visited and had no specialist knowledge of. It was the summer of 2007, and my son was fighting the Penguin and the Puffin, and my country was fighting Iraq and Afghanistan, and my husband was forming public opinion. It was the kind of summer when no one took their costume off. I pulled my husband away from the phone. I pulled him into the bedroom by the tasseled cord of his dressing gown, because I had read somewhere that this sort of behaviour would excite him. I pulled him down onto our bed. I remember the way he moved inside me, like a clock with its mainspring running down. I pulled his face close to mine, and I whispered, "Oh God, Andrew, are you all right?" My husband didn't reply. He just closed his eyes against the tears, and we began to move faster, while small, involuntary moans came from our mouths and fled into the other's moaning in wordless desperation. In on this small tragedy walked my son, who was more at home fighting evil on a larger, more knockabout scale. I opened my eyes and saw him standing in the bedroom doorway, watching us through the small diamond-shaped eye-holes of his bat mask. From the expression on the part of his face that could be seen, he seemed to be wondering which, if any, of the gadgets on his utility belt might help in this situation. When I saw my son, I pushed Andrew off me and scrabbled frantically for the duvet to cover us. I said, "Oh God, Charlie, I'm so sorry." My son looked behind him, then back at me.
"Charlie isn't here. I'm Batman."
I nodded and bit my lip.
"Good morning, Batman."
"What is you and Daddy doing, Mummy?"
"Is
you getting baddies?"
"Are we getting baddies, Charlie? Not is we."
"Are you?"
"Yes, Batman.
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing."
I smiled at my son and waited.
I wondered what Batman would say. What he said was,
"Someone done a poo in my costume, Mummy."
"Did a poo, Charlie?"
"Yes, a big, big poo."
"Oh, Batman, have you really done a poo in your suit?"
Batman shook his head. His bat ears quivered. Beneath the mask, an expression of great cunning settled upon the visible part of his face.
"It wasn't me that done the poo. It was the puffin."
"Are you telling me that the puffin came in the night and did a poo in your bat suit?" Batman nodded solemnly. I noticed he had kept his bat mask on, but taken off his bat suit. He stood naked except for the mask and cape. He held up the bat suit for me to inspect. A lump of something fell from it and thumped on the carpet. The smell was indescribable. I sat up in bed and saw a trail of lumps leading across the carpet from the bedroom door. Somewhere inside me, the girl who had done science A-levels noted, with empirical fascination, that feces had also found their way into locations which included, but were not limited to, Batman's hands, the doorframe, the bedroom wall, my alarm clock radio, and, of course, the bat suit. My son's shit was everywhere. There was shit on his hands, shit on his face, even on the black and yellow bat symbol of his bat suit, there was shit. I tried, but I couldn't make myself believe that these were puffin droppings. This was bat shit. Distantly, I remembered something I'd read on the parenting page.
"It's all right, Batman. Mummy's not cross. Mummy clean the poo up."
Jesus. Gravely, Batman shook his head.
"No, not Jesus. Mummy."
Resentfulness was starting to overcome the embarrassment and guilt. I looked across to where Andrew lay with his eyes tight closed and his hands twisted at the exquisite awfulness of his clinical depression, our unhappy sex interrupted, and this very thick stink of shit.
"Batman, why don't you ask Daddy to clean you up?"
My son looked across at his father for a long time, then turned back to me. Patiently, as if explaining something to an imbecile, he shook his little head again.
"But why not?" I was pleading now. "Why not ask Daddy?"
Batman looked solemn.
"Daddy is fighting baddies," he said.
The grammar was irreproachable. I looked across at his father with him, and I sighed. "Yes," I said, "I suppose you're right." 5 days later, on the last morning I saw my husband alive, I finished dressing my caped crusader. I breakfasted him and ran him down to his nursery's early birds club. Back at the house, I showered. Andrew watched me as I pulled on my tights. I always dressed up for deadline days. Heels, skirt, smart green jacket. Magazine publishing has its rhythms, and if the editor won't dance to them, she can't expect her staff to. I don't float feature ideas in Fendi heels, and I don't close an issue in Pumas. So I dressed against the clock while Andrew lay naked on the bed and watched me. He didn't say a word. The last glimpse I had of him, before I closed the bedroom door, he was still watching. How to describe to my son his father's last seen expression? I decided I would tell my son that his father had looked very peaceful. I decided I wouldn't tell him that my husband opened his mouth to say something, but that I was running late and turned away. I arrived at the office around 9:30. The magazine was based in Spitalfields, on Commercial Street, 90 minutes by public transport from Kingston-upon-Thames. The worst moment comes when you leave the overland network and descend into the heat of the underground. There were 200 of us packed into each tube carriage. We listened to the screech of the metal wheels on the track, with our bodies pinned and immobile. For 3 stops I stood pressed against a thin man in a corduroy jacket who was quietly weeping. One would normally avert one's eyes, but my head was pinioned in such a position that I could only look. I should have liked to put an arm around the man, but my arms were jammed by the commuters on each side of me. Besides, I wasn't sure I was up to administering tenderness like that, on a crowded train, under the silent gaze of others. I was torn between two kinds of shame. On the one hand, the disgrace of not discharging a human obligation. On the other hand, the madness of being the first in the crowd to move. I smiled helplessly at the weeping man, and I couldn't stop thinking about Andrew. As soon as one emerges above ground, of course, one can quickly forget our human obligations. London is a beautiful machine for doing that. The city was bright, fresh and inviting that morning. I was excited about closing the June issue, and I practically ran the last 2 minutes to the office. On the outside of our building was the magazine's name, Nixie, in 3-foot-high pink neon letters. I stood outside for a moment, taking a few deep breaths. The air was still, and you could hear the neon crackling over the rumble of the traffic. I stood with my hand on the door and wondered what Andrew had been about to say just before I left home. My husband hadn't always been lost for words. The long silences only began on the day we met little B. Before that, he wouldn't pipe down for a minute. On our honeymoon, we talked and talked. We stayed in a beachfront villa, and we drank rum and lemonade, and talked so much that I never even noticed what colour the sea was. Whenever I need to stop and remind myself how much I once loved Andrew, I only need to think about this, that the ocean covers 7/10 of the Earth's surface, and yet my husband could make me not notice it. This is how big he was for me. When we got back to our new married house in Kingston, I asked Andrew about the colour of that honeymoon sea. He said,
"Yeah, was it blue?"
I said, "Come on, Andrew, you're a pro. You can do better than that." And Andrew said,
"Okay, then. The awesome ocean fastness was a splendour of ultramarine crested with crimson and gold, where the burnished sun blazed on the wave-tops and sent them crashing into the gloomy troughs, deepening to a dark, malevolent indigo."
He hung on the penultimate syllable, deepening his voice in comic pomposity even as he raised his eyebrows.
"Indigo," he boomed. "Of course you know why I didn't notice the sea. It was because I spent 2 weeks with my head..."
Well, where my husband's head was is between me and him. We both giggled helplessly and rolled around on the bed, and Charlie, dear Charlie, was conceived. I pushed open the street door and stepped up into the lobby of the magazine. The black Italian marble floor was the only grace note that had survived our tenancy of the offices. The rest of the lobby was pure us. Boxes of sample frocks from wannabe fashion houses were stacked up along one wall. Some intern had triaged them with a chunky blue marker. "Yes, keep for shoot," or, "Oh, I think not," or the triumphant, the absolutist, "This is not fashion." A dead Japanese juniper tree stood in a cracked gold otagiri vase. 3 glittering Christmas baubles still hung from it. The walls were done up in fuchsia and fairy lights, and even in the dim sunshine from the tinted windows that gave onto Commercial Street, the paintwork looked marked and tatty. I cultivated this unkempt look. Nixie wasn't supposed to be like the other women's magazines. Let them keep their spotless lobbies and their smug Eames chairs. When it comes right down to editorial choices, I would rather have a bright staff and a dim lobby. Clarissa, my features editor, came through the doors just after me. We kissed once, twice, 3 times. We'd been friends since school, and she hooked her arm around mine as we took the stairs together. The editorial floor was right at the top of the building. We were halfway up before I realized what was wrong with Clarissa. "Clarissa, you're wearing yesterday's clothes." She smirked. "So would you be if you'd met yesterday's man." "Oh, Clarissa, what am I going to do with you?" "Pay rise, strong coffee, paracetamol," she beamed as she ticked off the points on her fingers. I reminded myself that Clarissa did not have some of the wonderful things I had in my life, such as my beautiful son Batman, and that she was therefore almost certainly less fulfilled than I was. It was a 10:30 a.m. start for my junior staff, bless them, and none of them were in yet. Up on the editorial floor, the cleaners were still in. They were hoovering and dusting desktops and turning upside down all the framed photos of my staff's awful boyfriends to prove they'd dusted under them. This was the grin and bear it part of editing Nixie. At Vogue or Marie Claire, one's editorial staff would be at their desks by 8, dressed in Chloe and sipping green tea. On the other hand, they wouldn't still be there at midnight, scrawling "Ceci n'est pas prêt à porter" on a sample box they were returning to a venerable Paris fashion house. Clarissa sat on the corner of my desk, and I sat behind it, and we looked out over the open plan at the gang of black faces spiriting away yesterday's fabric swatches and Starbucks cups. We talked about the issue we were closing. The ad sales people had done unusually well that month. Perhaps the spiraling cost of street drugs had forced them to spend more time in the office, and we realized we had more editorial material than space. I had a real-life feature I really thought should go in, a profile of a woman who was trying to get out of Baghdad, and Clarissa had a piece on a new kind of orgasm you could apparently only get with the boss. We talked about which of them we would run with. I was only half concentrating. I texted Andrew to see how he was doing. The flat screen at our end of the floor was showing BBC News 24 with the sound down. They were running a segment on the war. Smoke was rising above one of the countries involved. Don't ask me which. I'd lost track by that stage. The war was 4 years old. It had started in the same month my son was born, and they'd grown up together. At first, both of them were a huge shock and demanded constant attention, but as each year went by, they became more autonomous, and one could start to take one's eye off them for extended periods. Sometimes a particular event would cause me momentarily to look at one or other of them, my son or the war, with my full attention, and at times like these I would always think, "Gosh, haven't you grown?" I was interested in how this new kind of orgasm was meant to work. I looked up from the texting. "How come you can only have it with your boss?" "It's a forbidden fruit thing, isn't it? You get an extra frisson from breaking the office taboo, from hormones and neurotransmitters and so forth. You know, science." "Have scientists actually proved this?" "Don't get empirical with me, Sarah. We're talking about a whole new realm of sexual pleasure. We're calling it the B-spot. B as in boss. See what we did there?"
"Ingenious."
"Thank you, darling. We do try."
I wept inwardly at the thought of women up and down the country being pleasured by middle managers in shiny-bottomed suits. On the flat screen, News 24 had panned from the Middle East to Africa. Different landscape, same column of thick black smoke. A pair of jaundiced eyes looking out with the same impassivity Andrew had shown just before I turned away to leave for work. The hairs on my arms went up again. I looked away and took the 3 steps to the window that gave out onto Commercial Street. I put my forehead against the glass, which is something I do when I'm trying to think.
"Are you all right, Sarah?"
"I'm fine. Listen, be a doll and go and grab us a couple of coffees, would you?"
Clarissa went off to our idiosyncratic coffee machine, the one that would have been an in-house salon de thé in Vogue's offices. Down on Commercial Street, a police patrol car pulled up and parked at the curb in front of our building. A uniformed officer got out on each side. They looked at each other over the patrol car roof. One of them had blonde cropped hair, and the other had a bald patch as round and neat as a monk's. I watched him tilt his head to listen to the radio on his lapel. I smiled, thinking absently about a project Charlie was doing at his nursery. The police, people who help us, it was called. My son, it goes without saying, was magnificently unconvinced. At constant high alert in his bat cape and mask, Charlie believed a proud citizenry should be ready to help itself. Clarissa came back with two plasticky lattes. In one of them, the coffee machine had deposited a clear acrylic stirrer. In the other, it had elected not to do so. Clarissa hesitated over which to give me.
"First big editorial decision of the day," she said.
"Easy. I'm the boss. Give me the one with the stirrer."
"What if I don't?"
"Then we may never get around to locating your B-spot, Clarissa. I'm warning you." Clarissa blanched and passed me the coffee with the stirrer. I said, "I like the Baghdad piece." Clarissa sighed and slumped her shoulders.
"So do I, Sarah. Of course I do. It's a great article."
5 years ago, that's the one we'd have run with, no question.
5 years ago, our circulation was so low we had to take those risks.
And that's how we got big, by being different. That's us. Clarissa shook her head.
"Getting big's different from staying big. You know as well as I do, we can't be serving up morality tales while the other majors are selling sex."
"But why do you think our readers got dumber?"
"It's not that. I think our original readers aren't reading magazines anymore, that's all. They moved on to greater things. The same way you could if you'd just play the bloody game. Maybe you don't realize just how big you are now, Sarah. Your next job could be editing a national newspaper."
I sighed. How thrilling. I could put topless girls on every page. My missing finger itched. I looked back down at the police patrol car. The two officers were putting on their uniform caps. I tapped my mobile against my front teeth.
"Let's go for a drink after work, Clarissa. Bring your new man if you like. I'm bringing Andrew."
"Seriously? Out in public? With your husband? Isn't that terribly last season?"
"It's terribly 5 years ago."
Clarissa tilted her head at me.
"What are you telling me, Sarah?"
"I'm not telling you anything, Clara. I like you too much to tell. I'm just asking myself, really. I'm asking if maybe the kind of choices I made 5 years ago weren't so bad after all."
Clarissa smiled resignedly.
"Fine, but don't expect me to keep my hands off his hunky thighs under the table just because he's your husband."
"You do that, Clarissa, and I'll make you junior horoscopes editor for the rest of your natural life."
My desk phone rang. I looked at the time on its screen. 10:25 a.m. It's funny how these details stay with you. I picked up the phone and it was reception, sounding bored to distraction. At Nixie we used reception as a sin bin. If a girl got too bitchy on the editorial floor, we sent her down to do a week on the shiniest desk.
"There are two policemen here."
"Oh, they came in here. What do they want?"
"Okay, let me think about why I might have dialed your number."
"They want to talk to me?"
"They did good when they made you the boss, Sarah."
"Fuck off. Why do they want to talk to me?"
A pause.
"I could ask them, I suppose."
"If it isn't too much trouble." A longer pause.
"They say they want to shoot a porny film in the office. They say they're not real policemen, and their willies are simply enormous."
"Oh, for God's sake, tell them I'll be down." I hung up the phone and looked at Clarissa. The hairs on my arms were up again.
"The police," I said.
"Relax," said Clarissa. "They can't bust you for conspiracy to run a serious feature piece."
Behind her, the flat screen was showing John Stewart. He was laughing. His guest was laughing, too. I felt better. You had to find something to laugh about that summer. the number of places that were going up in smoke. You laughed, or you put on a superhero costume, or you tried for some kind of orgasm that science had somehow missed. I took the stairs down to the lobby, speeding up as I went. The two police officers were standing rather too close together, with their caps in their hands and their big sensible leather shoes on my black marble. The young one was blushing horribly.
"I'm so sorry," I said.
I glared at the receptionist, and she grinned back at me from beneath her perfect blonde side part.
"Sarah O'Rourke?"
"Summers."
"Excuse me, madam."
"Sarah Summers is my professional name."
The older policeman looked at me with no expression.
"This is a personal matter, Mrs. O'Rourke. Is there somewhere we can go?"
I walked them up to the boardroom on the first floor. Tones of pink and violet, long glass table, more neon.
"Can I get you a coffee or tea? I mean, I can't absolutely guarantee it'll come out as coffee or tea. Our machine is a bit..."
"Perhaps you'd better sit down, Mrs. O'Rourke."
The officer's face glowed unnaturally in the pinkish light. They looked like black-and-white movie men, coloured in by a computer. One older, the one with the bald patch, maybe 45. The younger one with the blonde-cropped hair, maybe 22 or 24. Nice lips, quite full, and rather juicy-looking. He wasn't beautiful, but I was transfixed by the way he stood and cast his eyes down deferentially when he spoke. And, of course, there's always something about a uniform. You wonder if the protocol will peel off with the jacket, I suppose. The two of them placed their uniform caps on the purple smoked glass. They rotated the caps with their clean white fingers. Both of them stopped at exactly the same moment, as if some critical angle they had practiced in basic training had precisely been attained. They stared at me. My mobile chimed brashly on the glass desktop, a text message arriving. I smiled. That would be Andrew.
"I've got some bad news for you, Mrs. O'Rourke," said the older officer.
"What do you mean?"
It came out more aggressive than I intended. The policemen stared at their caps on the table. I needed to look at the text message that had just arrived. As I reached out my hand to pick up the phone, I saw the two of them staring at the stump of my missing finger.
"Oh, this. I lost it on holiday. On a beach, actually."
The two policemen looked at each other. They turned back to me. The older one spoke. His voice was suddenly hoarse.
"We're very sorry, Mrs. O'Rourke."
"Oh, please don't be. It's fine, really. I'm fine now. It's just a finger."
"That's not what I meant, Mrs. O'Rourke. I'm afraid we've been instructed to tell you that."
"See, honestly, you get used to doing without the finger. At first you think it's a big deal, and then you learn to use the other hand."
I looked up and saw the two of them watching me, grey-faced and serious. Neon crackled. On the wall clock, a fresh minute snapped over the old one.
"The really funny thing is, I still feel it, you know? My finger, I mean. This missing one. Sometimes it actually itches. And I go to scratch it and there's nothing there, of course. And in my dreams, my finger grows back, and I'm so happy to have it back, even though I've learned to do without it. Isn't that silly? I miss it, do you see? It itches."
The young officer took a deep breath and looked down at his notebook.
"Your husband was found unconscious at your property shortly after 9 this morning, Mrs. O'Rourke. Your neighbour heard cries and placed a 999 call to the effect that a male was apparently in distress. Police attended the address and forced entry to an upstairs room at 9:15 a.m. when Andrew O'Rourke was found unconscious. Our officers did everything they could, and an ambulance attended and removed the casualty. But I am very sorry to tell you, Mrs. O'Rourke, that your husband was pronounced dead at the scene at, here we are, 9:33 a.m.
The policeman closed his pad.
"We're very sorry, madam."
I picked up my phone. The new text was indeed from Andrew.
"So sorry," it said. He was sorry.
I switched the phone and myself onto silent mode. The silence lasted all week. It rumbled in the taxi home. It howled when I picked up Charlie from nursery. It crackled on the phone call with my parents. It roared in my ears while the undertaker explained the relative merits of oak and pine caskets. It cleared its throat apologetically when the obituary's editor of the Times telephoned to check some last details. Now the silence had followed me into the cold, echoing church. How to explain death to a 4-year-old superhero? How to announce the precipitous arrival of grief? I hadn't even accepted it myself. When the policeman told me that Andrew was dead, my mind refused to contain the information. I am a very ordinary woman, I think, and I am quite well equipped to deal with everyday evil. Interrupted sex, tough editorial decisions, and malfunctioning coffee machines. These my mind could readily accept. But my Andrew dead? It still seemed physically impossible. At one point he had covered more than 7/10 of the Earth's surface. And yet here I was, staring at Andrew's plain oak coffin. A classic choice, madam. And it seemed rather small in the wide nave of the church. A silent, sickening dream.
Mummy, where's Daddy?
I sat in the front pew of the church with my arms around my son and realized I had begun to tremble. The vicar was delivering the eulogy. He was talking about my husband in the past tense. He made it sound very neat. It occurred to me that he had never had to deal with Andrew in the present tense, or proofread his columns, or feel him running down inside like a piece of broken clockwork. Charlie squirmed in my arms and asked his question again, the same one he'd asked 10 times a day since Andrew died.
"Mummy, where's my daddy exactly now?"
I leaned down to his ear and whispered, "He's in a really nice bit of heaven this morning, Charlie. There's a lovely long room where they all go after breakfast, with lots of interesting books and things to do."
"Oh, is there painting and drawing?"
"Yes, there's painting and drawing."
"Is my daddy doing drawing?"
"No, Charlie. Daddy is opening the window and looking at the sky." I shivered and wondered how long I would have to go on narrating my husband's afterlife. More words, then hymns. Hands took my elbows and led me outside. I observed myself standing in a graveyard beside a deep hole in the ground. 6 suited undertakers were lowering a coffin on thick green silky ropes with tasseled ends. I recognized it as the coffin that had been standing on trestles at the front of the church. The coffin came to rest. The undertakers retrieved the ropes, each with a deft flick of the wrist. I remember thinking, "I bet they do this all the time," as if it was some brilliant insight. Someone thrust a lump of clay into my hand. I realized I was being invited, urged even, to throw it into the hole. I stepped up to the edge. Clean greengrocer's grass had been laid across the border of the grave. I looked down and saw the coffin glowing palely in the depths. Batman held tight to my leg and peered down into the gloom with me.
"Mummy, why did the Bruce Wayne men put that box down in the hole?"
"Let's not think about that now, darling." I'd spent so many hours explaining heaven to Charlie that week, every room and bookshelf and sandpit of it, that I never really dealt with the issue of Andrew's physical body at all. I thought it would be too much to ask of my son, at 4, to understand the separation between body and soul. Looking back on it now, I think I underestimated a boy who could live simultaneously in Kingston-upon-Thames and Gotham City. I think if I'd managed to sit him down and explain it to him gently, he would have been perfectly happy with the duality. I knelt and put my arm around my son's shoulders. I did it to be tender, but my head was swimming, and I realized that perhaps it was only Charlie who was stopping me from falling down the hole. I held on tighter. Charlie put his mouth to my ear and whispered, "Where's my daddy right now?" I whispered back, "Your daddy is in the Heaven Hills, Charlie. Very popular at this time of year. I think he's very happy there."
Is my daddy coming back soon?"
"No, Charlie. People don't come back from heaven. We talked about that." Charlie pursed his lips.
"Mummy," he said again, "why did they put that box down there?"
"I suppose they want to keep it safe."
"Oh, is they going to come and get it later?"
"No, Charlie, I don't think so." Charlie blinked. Under his bat mask, he screwed up his face with the effort of trying to understand.
"Where is heaven, Mummy?"
"Please, Charlie, not now."
"What's in that box?"
"Let's talk about this later, darling, all right? Mummy is feeling rather dizzy." Charlie stared at me.
"Is my daddy in that box?"
"Your daddy is in heaven, Charlie."
"Is that box heaven?" said Charlie loudly.
Everyone was watching us. I couldn't speak. My son stared into the hole. Then he looked up at me in absolute alarm.
"Mummy, get him out! Get my daddy out of heaven!"
I held tightly onto his shoulders. "Oh, Charlie, please, you don't understand."
"Get him out! Get him out!"
My son squirmed in my grip and broke free. It happened very quickly. He stood at the very edge of the hole. He looked back at me, and then he turned and inched forward. But the greengrocer's grass overlapped the edge of the hole, and it yielded under his feet, and he fell, with his bat cape flying behind him, down into the grave. He landed with a thump on top of Andrew's coffin. There was a single urgent scream from one of the other mourners. I think it was the first sound since Andrew died that really broke the silence. The scream ran on and on in my mind. I felt nauseous, and the horizon lurched insanely. Still kneeling, I leaned out over the edge of the pit. Down below, in the dark shadow, my son was banging on the coffin and screaming, "Daddy! Daddy! Get out!" He clung to the coffin lid and planted his bat shoes against the side wall of the grave and heaved against the screws that held the lid closed. I hung my arms down over the edge of the hole. I implored Charlie to take my hands so I could pull him back up. I don't think he heard me at all. At first, my son moved with a breathless confidence. Batman was undefeated after all that spring. He had overcome the Penguin, the Puffin, and Mr. Freeze. It was simply not a possibility in my son's mind that he might not overcome this new challenge. He screamed in rage and fury. He wouldn't give up. But if I am strict and force myself now to decide upon the precise moment in this whole story when my heart irreparably broke, it was the moment when I saw the weariness and the doubt creep into my son's small muscles as his fingers slipped for the 10th time from the pale oak lid. The mourners clustered around the edge of the grave, paralyzed by the horror of this thing, this first discovery of death that was worse than death itself. I tried to go forward, but the hands on my elbows were holding me back. I strained against their grip and looked at all the horror-struck faces around the grave, and I was thinking, why doesn't someone do something? But it is hard, very hard, to be the first. Finally, it was little B who went down into the grave and held up my son for other hands to haul out. Charlie was kicking and biting and struggling furiously in his muddied mask and cape. He wanted to go back down, and it was little B,
once she herself had been extricated, who hugged him and held him back as he screamed, "No, no, 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 no!" while each of the principal mourners stepped onto the thin strips of greengrocer's grass and dropped in their small handfuls of clay. My son's screaming seemed to go on for a cruelly long time. I remember wondering if my mind would shatter with the noise, like a wine glass broken by a soprano. In fact, a former colleague of Andrew's, a war reporter who had been in Iraq and Darfur, did call me a few days later with the name of a combat fatigue counselor he used. "That's kind of you," I told him, "but I haven't been at war." At the graveside, when the screaming was over, I picked up Charlie and held him on my front, with his head resting on my shoulder. He was exhausted. Through the eye holes of his back mask, I could see his eyelids drooping. I watched the other mourners filing away in a slow line toward the car park. Brightly colored umbrellas broke out above the somber suits. It was starting to rain. Little B stayed behind with me. We stood by the side of the grave, and we stared at each other. "Thank you," I said.
"It is nothing," said Little B. "I just did what anyone would do."
"Yes," I said, "except that everyone else didn't." Little B shrugged.
"It is easier when you are from outside."
I shivered. The rain came down harder. "This is never going to end," I said. "Is it, Little B?"
"However long the moon disappears, some day it must shine again. That is what we used to say in my village. April showers bring May flowers. That's what we used to say in mine."
We tried to smile at each other.
I never did drop my own clay into the grave. I couldn't seem to put it down either. 2 hours later, alone for a moment at the kitchen table of our house, I realized I was still gripping it. I left it there on the tablecloth, a small beige lump on top of the clean blue carton. When I came back a few minutes later, someone had been past and tidied it. A few days later, the obituary in the Times noted that there had been poignant scenes at their former columnist's funeral. Andrew's editor sent me the cutting in a heavy cream envelope with a crisp white compliments slip. Chapter 3. One of the things I would have to explain to the girls from back home if I was telling them this story is the simple little word horror. It means something different to the people from my village. In your country, if you are not scared enough already, you can go to watch a horror film. Afterward, you can go out of the cinema into the night, and for a little while, there is horror in everything. Perhaps there are murderers lying in wait for you at home. You think this because there is a light on in your house that you are certain you did not leave on. And when you remove your makeup in the mirror last thing, you see a strange look in your own eyes. It is not you. For 1 hour you are haunted, and you do not trust anybody. And then the feeling fades away. Horror in your country is something you take a dose of to remind yourself that you are not suffering from it. For me and the girls from my village, horror is a disease, and we are sick with it. It is not an illness you can cure yourself of by standing up and letting the big red cinema seat fold itself up behind you. That would be a good trick. If I could do that, please believe me, I would already be standing in the foyer. I would be laughing with the kiosk boy and exchanging British £1 coins for hot buttered popcorn and saying, "Phew, thank the good Lord all that is over. That is the most frightening film I ever saw, and I think next time I will go to see a comedy, or maybe a romantic film with kissing."
but the film in your memory, you cannot walk out of it so easily. Wherever you go, it is always playing. So when I say that I am a refugee, you must understand that there is no refuge. Some days I wonder how many there are just like me. Thousands, I think, just floating on the oceans right now, in between our world and yours. If we cannot pay smugglers to transport us, we stow away on cargo ships. In the dark, in freight containers, breathing quietly in the darkness, hungry, hearing the strange clanking sounds of ships, smelling the diesel oil and the paint, listening to the bom-bom-bom of the engines. Wide awake at night, hearing the singing of whales rising up from the deep sea and vibrating through the ship. All of us whispering, praying, thinking. And what are we thinking of? Of physical safety, of peace of mind, of all these imaginary countries that are now being served in the foyer. I stowed away in a great steel boat, but the horror stowed away inside me. When I left my homeland, I thought I had escaped, but out on the open sea, I started to have nightmares. I was naive to suppose I had left my country with nothing. It was a heavy cargo that I carried. They unloaded my cargo in a port on the estuary of the Thames River. I did not walk across the gangplank. I was carried off the ship by your immigration officials, and they put me into detention. It was no joke inside the detention center. What will I say about this? Your system is cruel, but many of you were kind to me. You sent charity boxes. You dressed my horror in boots and a colorful shirt. You sent it something to paint its nails with. You posted it books and newspapers. Now the horror can speak the Queen's English. This is how we can speak now of sanctuary and refuge. This is how I can tell you, soon, soon, as we say in my country, a little about the things I was running from. There are things the men can do to you in this life, I promise you. It would be much better to kill yourself first. Once you have this knowledge, your eyes are always flickering from this place to that, watching for the moment when the men will come. In the immigration detention center, they told us we must be disciplined to overcome our fears. This is the discipline I learned. Whenever I go into a new place, I work out how I would kill myself there. In case the men come suddenly, to make sure I am ready. The first time I went into Sarah's bathroom, I was thinking, yes, little B, in here you would break the mirror of that medicine cabinet and cut your wrists with the splinters. When Sarah took me for a ride in her car, I was thinking, here, little B, you would roll down the window and unbuckle your seatbelt and tip yourself out of the window. No fuss. In front of the very next lorry that comes the other way. And when Sarah took me for a day in Richmond Park, she was looking at the scenery, but I was looking for a hollow in the ground where I could hide and lie very still until all that she would find of me was a small white skull that the foxes and the rabbits would fuss over with their soft, wet noses. If the men come suddenly, I will be ready to kill myself. Do you feel sorry for me, for thinking always in this way? If the men come and they find you not ready, then it will be me who is feeling sorry for you. For the first 6 months in the detention center, I screamed every night, and in the day I imagined 1,000 ways to kill myself.
I worked out how to kill myself in every single one of the situations a girl like me might get into in the detention center. In the medical wing, morphine. In the cleaner's room, bleach. In the kitchens, boiling fat. You think I am exaggerating? Some of the others that were detained with me, they really did these things. The detention officers sent the bodies away in the night because it was not good for the local people to see the slow ambulances leaving that place. Or what if they released me, and I went to a movie and I had to kill myself there? I would throw myself down from the projection gallery, or a restaurant. I would hide in the biggest refrigerator and go into a long, cool sleep. Or the seaside. Ah, at the seaside, I would steal an ice cream van and drive it into the sea. You would never see me again. The only thing to show that a frightened African girl had ever existed would be 2,000 melting ice creams bobbing in their packets on the cool blue waves. After 100 sleepless nights, I had finished working out how to kill myself in every single corner of the detention center and the country outside. But I still carried on imagining. I was weak from horror, and they put me in the medical wing. Away from the other prisoners, I lay between the scratchy sheets, and I spent each day all alone in my mind. I knew they planned to deport me, so I started to imagine killing myself back home in Nigeria. It was just like killing myself in the detention center, but the scenery was nicer. This was a small and unexpected happiness. In forests, in quiet villages, on the sides of mountains, I took my own life again and again. In the most beautiful places, I secretly lingered over the act. Once, in a deep and hot jungle that smelled of wet moss and the excrement of monkeys, I took nearly one whole day to chop down trees and build a tall tower to hang myself from by the neck. I had a machete. I imagined the sticky sap on my hands and the sweet honey smell of it, the good tired feeling in my arms from the chopping, and the screeches of the monkeys who were angry when I cut their trees down. I worked hard in my imagination, and I tied the tree trunks together with vines and creepers, and I used a special knot that my sister Enkiruka showed me. It was a big day's work for a small girl. I was proud. At the end of that whole day alone in my sickbed, working on my suicide tower, I realized I could just have climbed a jungle tree and jumped with my silly head first onto a rock. This was the first time that I smiled. I began to eat the meals they brought me. I thought to myself, "You must keep up your strength, little bee, or you will be too weak to kill your foolish self when the time arrives, and then you will be sorry." I started to walk from the medical wing to the canteen at mealtimes, so that I could choose my food instead of having it brought to me. I started asking myself questions like, "Which will make me stronger for the act of suicide? The carrots or the peas?" In the canteen there was a television that was always on. I began to learn more about life in your country. I watched programs called Love Island and Hell's Kitchen and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And I worked out how I would kill myself on all of those shows. Drowning, knives, and ask the audience. One day, the detention officers gave all of us a copy of a book called Life in the United Kingdom. It explains the history of your country and how to fit in. I planned how I would kill myself in the time of Churchill, stand under bombs, Victoria, throw myself under a horse, and Henry VIII, marry Henry VIII.
I worked out how to kill myself under Labour and Conservative governments, and why it was not important to have a plan for suicide under the Liberal Democrats. I began to understand how your country worked. They moved me out of the medical wing. I still screamed in the night,